All right, Matt Toogood, welcome to the show.
Lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you. I've been really, really excited to have you on the show after I had discovered Royal Coffee about a year ago. If anybody knows how much I like my whiskey, I think I like my coffee, my morning coffee, even better. And it's just been, you know, if it wasn't for Royal Coffee, I don't think I would have upped my knowledge on everything from the beans to the machinery, to just the whole like world of coffee. And so thank you for like starting Royal Coffee with your partner, and thanks for coming to the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Look, I'm going to say one thing that's going to be really controversial right off the bat. People like yourself probably didn't get exposed to us until COVID came along. It's been one of the best things that has ever happened to our business is COVID, because we've actually had people taking the time to actually go and spend more energy and trying to find out about it. So
there you go. So one thing came that was good out of COVID was that, perhaps,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Let me right off the bat ask you, I mean, you guys came from New Zealand in 2007, right, to start the business here?
So Kim was here. Kim's been in the Middle East for nearly 28 years. Mm-hmm. And then she's been in Dubai for a long time. And I came up with my family 2008. Mm-hmm. So Raw started in 2007. And then 2008, I joined Kim, and then it went from there.
Yeah.
It was a different world back in 2007, 2008 in this country.
I remember. I mean, when I first moved here, the city was, I mean, even JLT as a location was still being built at the time, and that's just the real estate, never mind everything else that happened over the last 10 years. So it's just been a crazy, like, last, was it 13 years, not even 10 years?
I actually remember driving around the area we're in at the moment back 2009 and getting lost in here because there was no street lights. There was nothing, you know, and now look at the city. It's incredible.
It's amazing.
Such a.
I just hope that like they find a way to recover from what happened, because, I think I'm quite optimistic that somewhere in the leadership, if they manage to build the city out of nothing from the desert all the way to where it is today, I'd like to believe that we're going to get recover from Corona and, you know, get the tourists back and life is back to normal. People have jobs again and all that stuff. So it should be a matter of time, hopefully.
I'm super proud to be a Dubai startup.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Dubai is a very, very cool city. Dubai and the UAE is just a wonderful place if you are prepared to be here and be part of Dubai.
Right.
And, you know, like, I think that we'll recover quicker than anybody, you know. The fact that, you know, you can walk down the street and get a vaccination, you know, you can do all this sort of stuff. They'll do everything where they possibly can to get us back to trading and doing everything. And you know what? Sometimes a little bit of pain is gain as well. So, you know, there's been a few businesses that I've seen that have succeeded, and I've seen a lot of businesses that have failed.
Yeah.
But maybe they should have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's just part of it, right? Yeah. I had a venture capitalist on called Khaled Talhouni, episode 5, I think. And he just like right off the bat said, I mean, that's just part of it. Some businesses, it's the way that the natural order of this business world is that some companies can survive, others have to restart. And that's just, it's okay, right? I mean, it's not okay. It's easy for us to say that. But I mean, it's how it's been and how it's supposed to be. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, you know.
When I met Kim, and she won't mind me saying this, the business was basically bankrupt.
Yeah.
You know, she'd been going for a year, you know, put as much money as they had into the business. And, you know, within weeks of looking at the books, I'm just going to her, look, this is just not going to work.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have enough cash. And, you know, like, we're really proud today. The first year that we worked together, we sold 400 kilos of coffee.
Wow.
Now we roast 400 kilos a day minimum.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good
so,
for you guys.
You know, like, you know, there's got to be a business side to everything, and cash is king. And I ran the business before I had the luxury of employing people who are way better at me looking after accounts.
Yeah.
You know, I ran the business on an Excel spreadsheet, which was how much money do we have in the bank,
yeah.
Right? You know, and that's probably why, like, during COVID, we survived because we had cash in the bank. I always have a backup.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, you know, if you're living in a place where there's no handouts, right, we don't pay tax, so why would we expect the government to come in and help us out?
Sure, yeah.
Right, you run your own business, you know what it's like, you know, we make our own thing. So,
right.
You know, being here, that's a good thing because, you know, you create those barriers, you create those protection areas, and boom, you know.
What made you guys decide, or what made you decide to say, I'm going to come to Dubai, you know, coffee business, You know, you're from New Zealand, lovely place, a lot of nature. You know, my dream one day if I retire is to go to somewhere in Southeast Asia and maybe have like a little bar. And if it's not coffee or a little kind of obscure bar, maybe like sell magic mushrooms to like tourists. And so I think being in the hospitality business, you want to be like, what about saying I want to start a coffee business in Dubai out of all the places? And how did that decision happen? And raw coffee, what was the idea that made it?
Okay, so I have a place in Gili, just off Lombok, where okay. they have sell magic mushrooms to tourists. So I've got one of those, yes, and that's definitely something that you should do. What made me come here was my wife is actually an air traffic controller.
Oh, okay.
And I had worked for many years, and she had supported me in doing my work, working in telecoms and things. And she said, listen, if I want to do something, I want to, you know, I want to go to the place that's going to have the busiest airport in the world, and, you know, it's my turn. So we moved here. And I went and talked to lovely people at the local telecoms and realized that they were so far behind what I'd been doing that I didn't want to repeat what I'd been doing for 7-8 years.
Right.
So happened through friends to meet Kim and realized that, you know, I could bring something to a business, not just the fact that we actually needed a decent coffee, but I could actually bring my business experience to her passion. And it just worked out. The timing was fantastic. And so we kicked off, you know, raw version 2
yeah.
as it was back then. So that's why we're here. And it's actually hard to think back that long ago. Dubai was such a different place. Like you couldn't buy screws at the hardware store if you didn't speak Urdu.
Yeah.
You know, it was the Wild West, but it was also kind of exciting in that way.
Yeah.
The education here was better than we could get in New Zealand.
For your kids. You
mean. It cost a huge amount of money, but you know, when you had companies back then that were prepared to pay that money to bring expertise,
yeah.
you know, it was it was just the best thing to do.
Makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I have to say, like, when I first, I actually, it was due to COVID that I even came across Raw, and somebody who like drinks coffee every day, and I lived in New York and Brooklyn and Manhattan. I lived in East London. You get some of the best coffee houses in these cities, like very authentic, very kind of like unique and obscure. And I mean, the coffee is also fucking amazing. Then you come to Dubai, right? And then the city is amazing in many, many ways, but the coffee is shit.
Oh, it's just terrible.
It's really bad. Like you go to like, I mean, if it's, I'm not even going to comment on like the chains like Starbucks and Costa, like they make basic, I mean, the food is actually better than the coffee they make, if anything, but then there is no really good coffee here. And I was just dazzled by Raw. Not only is the coffee amazing, we'll talk about that in a second, but you guys created like a one-stop shop for all things coffee, for wholesalers and for retailers. So equipment, lessons, teaching people how to do the barista, like the barista course, which I, by the way, took online with one of your, I forgot her name, but she was incredible, over Zoom. So COVID responsible. But I now make coffee like a barista, right? And this machine, Rocket R60, which I know you also provide at your store. So how did you go from saying, look, let's have a coffee house to like, let's just do everything coffee? What sort of drove that decision? And because I think that's really what sets apart Raw from everybody else.
So in New Zealand, we have a bunch of villages. You know, New Zealand is a very advanced place. We're the earliest adopters of any technology. We love something new. Today I was very proud as a New Zealander that we won the America's Cup.
Congratulations.
Again, yeah. Using technology actually shows that Kiwis can fly. So when I've been growing up as a child, I remember the weekend sport my dad used to take me from, if I was playing cricket or soccer or rugby or whatever I was playing, and we would stop on the way home to go to the Jewish deli and we'd pick up bagels, and we'd go to the coffee roastery and pick up coffee. And that was just the way that it worked. And, you know, with my kids on the, you know, when they were finishing on a Saturday, we'd go by the coffee roastery as well. So you were used to having fresh coffee, and that's as simple as it gets. You know, coffee should be fresh.
Mm.
And so when we moved here, it was like, where do we get the coffee? there's some guy who, there's a roastery and they roast nuts. Yeah, okay. And you go in there and there was this black, oily guck. And it was like, the stuff's rancid before you even start. It's been roasted months ago or whatever. And it was like a panic set in, literally a panic set in.
Mm.
You know, just like, don't you understand? This is, you should treat this just like any fresh product. So, you know, we, it's, it, it, when you, when you suddenly realize that you're in a place that doesn't have what you are so used to, I suddenly went, okay, maybe I could actually roast coffee. So I contacted the roaster who I was buying from and said, I've got a business opportunity up in Dubai. I think that we could possibly do this. And he said, yeah, look, I'm keen on this. Let's investigate it. So I started doing a bit of business planning and working out what it is. And then I met Kim and realized that, you know, there was no reason for me to repeat what she had started. Why don't we actually work together? And then when we started to meet each other and we worked out that we could actually do this probably together better than individuals competing against each other.
Sure.
But to be honest, if you can remember back in the day, you didn't have to be the best in the world to be successful.
True.
So we got lucky. Like our business would have failed 20 times over if we'd been in our home country.
Right.
So we had an opportunity to try and really put our passion into it, and that was more, that was the benefit. My wife was working, Kim's husband was working, and we didn't have to rely on them every day to, we didn't need salaries. So
sure,
we didn't pay ourselves for many, many years.
That's amazing. But what does that saying go? Like the need is the mother of invention, right? So like a combination of, you need that product for yourself, first and foremost, but also like it lacks in Dubai, where, I mean, there's just not a good coffee house in the city, except, in my opinion, for Raw, but like very few others that don't even come close. But something like that is all it takes to just be like, let's just do it ourselves and not wait for it to be done by somebody else, right?
The satisfaction of creating something yourself is greater than anything else.
Sure.
So, you know, I think about the coffee that we were making 10, 12 years ago, and it was... it was better than whatever everybody else had in town, yeah, but it wasn't very good.
Yeah.
What we've learned is, so it's a very interesting situation. The Middle East has the ability to bring everything to it whenever they want because there's lots of money.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. So does that make it the best? Not necessarily. I think that sometimes, and one of my frustrations about being here is that people don't add value. My job is to add value. Yeah. So my job is to add value to the farmer that we buy from, to the team that we have. You know, all these value adds are the thing that I bring to the table.
Right.
And that's what makes our company. And what I hope is that what you experience when you come in is that feeling of 60 people adding value every day.
100%.
Not just turning up.
I actually, glad you mentioned farmers. I was going to ask you about that because as I was looking on your, you know, researching Raw and yourself also on your website, reading the literature you have there, it was mentioned several times and got my attention, the part on that your coffee is ethically sourced or sourced in a way. And it made me wonder, how unethical is the value chain of the coffee industry? I mean, I'm oblivious about it. I know there's a lot of exploitation and, you know, sweatshops and for like the big companies and so on. But for coffee, very oblivious and don't know much about it. So maybe could you tell me a little bit about how the ugly side of this industry and how you guys go about sourcing it ethically when you mentioned that?
Yeah, there's a hugely ugly side to all food production. You know, there's a massive amount of companies out there that are taking advantage of people who are just not important to them. We have been incredibly lucky in the sense that we've been able to start traveling about 2010. We started traveling to Origin. We first of all went and visited coffee competitions in the UK and thought that was important. And then once you actually go to the producing countries, you realize that that's where the most value you can add to the industry starts. I'm proud to say that this year, 99.9% of the coffee that we've bought, I've shaken hands with the people who produce it.
Lovely.
You know, and that's quite a difference. But what it means is not necessarily that I can pat myself on the back and say, aren't I a good person for making sure I know who made the coffee? It's more important because we can actually make a difference to the producers of the coffee. We can, there's little things that happen that once you go to an origin country, Kim says it better than I do, but when you drive and you turn up in a Land Cruiser, you drive for 10, 12 hours across very rough terrain and everything, and you arrive in these villages, immediately you can tell if the coffee's going to be good by the way that the children are, the way that the woman who do most of the work are looking, you know, whether or not it's a positive vibe. It completely changes the way the coffee tastes.
Fascinating.
But it's not. That's normal human society, right?
So is it the same logic that, and by the way, if you want to, before, I forgot. I'm glad I remembered. Cheers, the customary cheers. Thanks for coming on the show and for bringing this delicious bourbon. Got to fill you up as well. Mm-hmm. Let me just push the ice towards you. So one of the things that I had, since you're mentioning the regions where the coffee is made and also the things like the children and how they are and the energy of the people who are making that coffee and how that immediately indicates to you how good the coffee is going to be. I didn't even know this was, I was going to ask you about like the other aspects of making coffee, like washed versus natural, which I only also learned about from drinking coffee at Raw. The region, I know that plays a big factor, so I want to ask you about that. The dark versus medium roast, also curious to ask about that. But so these were the three variables that I thought come into the coffee making or the roasting process. But I'm glad you brought up that point on energy and about the mothers and the kids and how that also sort of makes its way to the coffee you drink. Because in many ways, when you're cooking food, like, I get skeptical sometimes about people who are too like into this energy talk, but to some extent, I have to admit it's true. When you make food with love and with like a little bit of kindness and compassion, you can almost feel like you're gonna get that delivered through and as a good flavor or as a good meal or a good beverage to your guests or to your family. So is this sort of what you're indicating here, or am I misunderstanding it?
No, not at all. Look, so I'm very much like you. I have a mother who's a white witch.
Same, by the way.
and they're wonderful people. But, you know, I've been brought up with energy being a topic in our house on one side of our family for many years. And I 100% believe in that there is a transference of energy that's going around the world. And, you know, what's really interesting is that Kim and I often say that things happen to us at the right time. And that has happened to us in our business so many times with people that we meet or things that happen, you know, as we're doing business. And I think that you can't be lazy. I think that you have to, you know, you have to work for what you're doing. But I also think that if you have, you know, a belief in something, that often that will sway and the thing. Like I was saying to some of the ladies that I work with who do our marketing and things the other day, I said, you know, it would be good if I could actually do a podcast. And they said to me, you know, why? I said, because often the conversation that I have about coffee is really, really short. But coffee, I could talk for 20 hours about coffee, you know. Yeah. And I think that what we're finding now in the Middle East is that we have jumped into this new coffee realm. Everybody's getting into it. And what's really cool and also really sad is that a lot of people here have never drunk bad coffee, or they've forgotten what bad coffee is, because they went from the terrible stuff that was available to the best of the best of the best.
Right.
And so now it's time to actually understand why it's good. And do you have to buy the best coffee? Can you buy an okay coffee and make it better? Right? Because making it is also, you know, really, really important.
Sure.
Most people don't realize that most of the coffee farmers that are producing the coffee that everybody's enjoying, they don't drink coffee. They can't afford to.
Of course.
But that's wrong.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so if we can go back down to the farm and work out how that we can help that farmer not get out of that subsistence life, that they only have the small amount of coffee that they produce every year, and that's hopefully going to feed their family.
Mm.
And you know, we're worried about, you know, whether or not it's, you know, what score it is. You know, like, there's a disconnect there. We have to get around that. So, you know, what is fantastic for us as a business right now is that Kim and I actually have the influence with the people that we're dealing with you, the customer,
mm-hmm.
to be able to say, stop. Would you like to learn about this farm? Would you like to learn about why it's important? You know, you can enjoy the coffee. We'll make sure that it's the best tasting coffee you get. But let's talk about what we can actually do to help these farmers. One of it's buying their coffee every year. That's fantastic.
Sure.
And hey, you know, we're not a charity. You know, we're a for-profit business. I think for fair and reasonable profit. But, you know, the most important discussion that we have to have is if you want to continue drinking the coffee that you're drinking now in 10 years' time, that we have to start looking back at the farms that are producing it. We have to look about the water that they can use. We have to look about whether or not, you know, that we are doing the right things with the climate to be able to do that. I'm, you know, I love trees, but I'm a tree hugger.
Yeah. Fair enough. And the thing is, I mean, the regions that we're talking about, which regions here? We're talking about areas like that are extremely like developing countries, right? So this is like Ethiopia, mm-hmm. Sumatra, obviously Colombia, maybe a little bit more developed. But I guess even when you become a farmer, it doesn't much matter. And if you're in these countries, which are already a developing country, and you're also a farmer, then you're probably going through a hard time for like economically, if nothing else. Never mind political oppression, whatever that might be, and so on. So what do you guys do aside of obviously selling the coffee of that comes out of these farmers and from these areas? How do you then do more than just that? What are some of the things you've done to educate the customers about where this coffee is coming from or otherwise? You know, you mentioned you go there and you actually meet these people in person, you shake their hands. I think this is amazing. What is the reaction that you're getting from those farmers compared to the other suppliers that these farmers give their coffee to from you guys? Like, what's the extra mile that you're going there? Could you shed some light on that?
So there's the purely capitalistic, tangible benefit that we give. So one of the businesses that we work through a lot is a company called Raw Material. Raw Material is a collective of incredibly intelligent people who have looked not just on the, you know, the purely ethical side of the business. They look at it and go, okay, what can we do?
Mm.
So I'm really happy that over the last 3 years, we can tangibly measure that we've paid 2.66 times the value to the farmer more than what they would have got on the open market.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's great. Right.
Now, does that affect you as a consumer? Yes, it does. But do I really think that that makes too much of a difference to you? Not really.
Lovely. So you're passing on extra. The farmer obviously is doubling or tripling whatever they are making. To them, that could be life changing.
Completely, because I mean, a coffee farmer, the average coffee farmer, when it was last measured by different associations, the average coffee farmer was earning $600 per year.
Oh my God!
Right. So
it's $2 a day, basically.
Basically. Or $3. Now they probably grow their own food. They, you know, doing everything, but they were, you know, there's some amazing documentaries out there that showed people that were in coffee were 3 months of the year, they were basically starving.
Mm.
So, you know, now we're, you know, the specialty coffee world is very, very small, right? Mm. The commodity coffee world is taking most of the coffee and that's not contributing. Mm. A huge amount of coffee farmers that I know, if they weren't being, using the word supported is immature. If we weren't buying from them, they would rip their coffee trees out and plant something else.
Yeah.
Right. So what we do is we try and encourage them in a commercial way because, I mean, we have to run a business. We have to make a profit.
Right.
And, you know, to try and get these farmers to convince that we will support them for not just 1 year, 2 years or 3 years, that we are there to support them is the most important thing.
Mm.
You know, and there's a – it's a challenging situation. I mean, mm. COVID was – you know, it was the amount of calls that I had with farmers, and I'm going, look, we will do everything we can. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know whether or not we can sell what we've even got in the fridge at the moment.
Right.
And what's been interesting is that, you know, people like yourself, you know, made a huge difference. You know, that impact was like, okay, so what can we do? Okay.
Yeah.
This is not just about us. This is about you. This is about your survival, mm. right? Because I want to be able to buy your coffee next year. So what do we need to do? How much do we need to send you, or what can we do? We had a terrible situation that the middle of May, mm-hmm. I was meant to be taking a bunch of people down to Rwanda for a trip down to see the whole coffee process, which is just the most amazing place to go and see coffee, is Rwanda. And they had a flood, and that flood killed 23 people. It wiped out over 2 million coffee trees. So we're in the middle of a COVID situation, and we have people who literally are homeless. They've lost their loved ones. They've lost their livelihood. And what was amazing is that the coffee community that I work in, the raw material community, was able to actually fundraise. And we were raising money during COVID for these people. Just to give them, and that's the difference when you're working with people who are genuinely – want to do good in the world.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, on a selfish level, of course, not just selfishly, but I would want these farmers to continue to exist and be okay, because I like my coffee. And I mean, of course, that's not the right reason to do it. But I can imagine if you love your coffee and you love where it's coming from, you're going to want to do everything to help the people who are, busting their ass to get that coffee out for you. For just to kind of, especially for us who are privileged enough to be in Dubai, where, as you said, you can pay twice the price of a cup of coffee. Instead of a 15 or 20 dirham espresso, I'll pay 30, 35, if that means that I can keep the value chain alive, especially the people that matter the most at the beginning of the value chain, then it makes a lot of sense.
I think that what we're going to have to do is work out who's making the money, right? And that's the stuff that Kim and I are working on. Hopefully in the next couple of months we're going to be able to announce what we're working on, which is to guarantee that that the money's going in the right place.
Right.
Right, because there are,
a bit of accountability.
This is a capitalistic society, and there's nothing wrong with capitalism.
Yeah.
Right, so, but there are a lot of people who ride on the coattails of a new enterprise.
Sure.
The coffee business in Dubai has I'm smirking because there's a lot of people have taken advantage of a trend,
yeah.
And that's fine. But I think that it'll all come and equalize itself, because it's going to be that we're going to find some genuine. A lot of people are going to not be able to survive the current economic climate,
right,
which is a good thing.
Yeah,
fair enough.
And so in terms of the regions, that's going to be aside of which one was, I guess everybody got affected quite badly, and even outside of COVID, these regions are dealing with God knows what. Where do you typically see the highest demand for your beans? So your customers, which beans do they typically like? The ones from Colombia, Sumatra, Ethiopia. My favorite is Sumatra, by the way. And I was trying to wonder, I love to drink espresso every day. So I do this, exactly as I was taught by your barista, 25 to 30 second extraction. I get the grind level to give me twice as much. So I put 19 grams of beans. It gives me 38 grams of extraction within 25 to 30 seconds. And I've tried all your beans. I love the black tie. I love, the LBD, the Ethiopian one. But my favorite one is the Sumatra one, which I know is washed and I know it's medium. And I don't know why I like it the most. It has a sandy, almost sandy. I'm going to use that adjective for the lack of a better one. But it has this foamy, sandy texture that I love for an espresso. So what goes on into the making of the coffee, the region, this roasting that makes espresso or coffee like people like coffee or espresso the way they do?
The most exciting thing for me is you to say that, because the best coffee that you can drink is the one that you love the most.
Oh, for real? That's the Sumatra one.
Why, we spend too much time telling each other what's the best, right? That coffee is not my favorite. I know a lot about it, and what you're doing by buying that coffee,
yeah,
is actually helping a lot of people and helping a lot of orangutans. But if you literally take that coffee and you put it on the world scale of the best coffees in the world, it's not really there. But you love it. So it's the perfect coffee for you.
It is, yeah.
Right? Sure. You were saying before, what is the most the most favorable coffees and things. Ethiopia is the birthplace of coffee. So out of Ethiopia, there's over 150 different varieties that have been mapped. The rest of the world has maybe 15 varieties. Slowly, we're exporting them quietly from Ethiopia and planting them around the world. We have a coffee that we're getting out of Colombia that is an exported coffee from Ethiopia that's been now being grown in Colombia through different ways that we transport things around the world, which is amazing. If Ethiopia ceases to exist, then coffee ceases to exist, because it's only a matter of time until disease or whatever destroys those species that have been liberated from Ethiopia. So that's a problem. And right now, Ethiopia is in a terrible economic situation, terrible social economic situation as well. This year has been incredibly difficult to get coffee from Ethiopia.
Yeah.
And we're really lucky that we actually have some producers down there that they know that we're going to need it, so you know we're the first ones to get it.
Yeah.
And Ethiopia, I have to say, is probably the place that I love most the coffee.
Right.
Colombia, oh my God, Colombia, you must go.
Okay.
Oh, as a country, it is just amazing.
Yeah.
The food in Colombia, the people, everything about Colombia is amazing, and you'd think that there's other things like. You'd think that cocaine is really, really big in Colombia. No, it's not. Coffee's actually, I think, the 29th biggest export out of Colombia.
Right.
Right? I think cocaine is like the 40th export. They export more rice than they export coffee.
I guess with the cocaine, it's probably exported in like a black market, so it's not being tracked as much with the Escobars and whatnot.
Nah, you'd be quite surprised. One of the coffees that you have probably drunk from us, and in fact, if you drunk, most of our blends actually contain one Colombian coffee, which is from Planetas, which is where the FARC have controlled the entire region for many, many years. So they disassociated themselves with the rest of Colombia, and they
the FARC. Okay.
Yeah. So it's in northern Tolima. We were incredibly lucky 2 years ago to go up there, and I believe that we were one of the first people outside of South America to visit there. There wasn't even a road in there before we went in. About 6 months before we went in there, they built a road. And and they were producing huge amounts of cocaine. And what's kind of funny is you get there and you talk to them, they're brilliant people. Because you go, okay, so what happened? They said, well, the Colombian government turned around and said that they were going to pay us to remove the cocaine. Went, okay, yeah. So what did you do? Well, we planted more cocaine so we could make more money. I mean, literally, this area went from producing something like 70,000 tons of cocaine per year to producing 210,000
right.
You know. But then they sort of also realized that, I mean, they're not consuming it, right? It doesn't destroy their society. They chew the coca leaf, they do it, you know, just as a normal part of society. But they're also producing coffee.
Right.
They're producing amazing, amazing cacao for chocolate.
Right.
And the cacao grows just below the coffee.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've got this whole production of growing coca, cacao, and coffee. And they're really happy.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I also understand they have to go through quite a bit of the leaves in order to create the extract of cocaine, whatever that is. I think you have to go through quite a bit to get the pure cocaine out of it. Then,
yeah. So I actually spent quite a lot of time talking to guys about what the difference was, because one of the things that they have is there's only a certain amount of people, right? So when it comes to coffee, you know, harvest, there is a draw on the community on how many people you can get to harvest. And so coffee is a cherry that grows on a tree, and it's ripe at a certain time, and you need to harvest it when it's ripe. Mm. So at the same time, you know, the cocaine is ready on the tree, the coca is ready to be plucked. So it's very easy to process the leaves, because all they do is they strip it. They strip it from the tree, and then it goes off. They just make bales of it. With a coffee, they're wanting to pick individual cherries, and it's much harder work.
Right.
And so there's always that sort of balance between, and the people that I've talked to in Colombia have been going, well, you know, I know it's better to do this, but this pays more.
Fair. Makes sense. And you also mentioned Ethiopia, right? And I know quite a bit about Ethiopia by now, because I didn't ask you that earlier before we started, but how well do you know the cryptocurrency Cardano and Charles Hoskinson? So this guy started this, you know, I'm sure you've heard of Bitcoin, and now there's quite a few other projects. Since Ethiopia is like, you know, at the forefront of coffee, this is where it's going to This is where the renaissance, if you wish, economically speaking, in Africa is going to start through this project called Cardano. Very smart guy called Charles Hoskinson. He's a mathematician. He's actually now like the third biggest cryptocurrency after Bitcoin and Ethereum as of today. I'm invested like balls deep into this project now. And very proud investor, to be honest, because this guy goes on and says, like, you know, if you're buying the coin for Cardano and you're trying to just make some quick buck, like get out of this project right now and go buy a bunch of other ones. But he is really on a mission to bank the unbanked in Africa. And we give the unbanked in Africa, like the farmers, I imagine, in Ethiopia are a good example. But probably many other, you know, individuals in Africa and professionals who just need some help bank across the different services that you could need as a person, from getting a loan to being able to mortgage something to getting an insurance, and everything in between, right? So hopefully something like this kind of cryptocurrency age that we're living in and other things that could happen will now bring these countries up to speed so that they can compete on a global scale without having to get exploited and hope that they can get some ethical buyers, much like you guys, to kind of keep them afloat, right?
So, I mean, the stuff that Kim and I are working on at the moment requires the blockchain. I mean, it needs that. And it also needs a cryptocurrency that can be used in places like South America and Africa. I mean, you've got to remember that a lot of these people are living hand-to-mouth, right? They will carry their water for 2.5 kilometers every day. They'll send their children at 3 years old with a 1 liter bottle to go and fill it up with water, you know? So, I've got friends who have millions of dollars stuck in Ethiopia. They can't remove it because the governments there control the birr and they won't let it get transferred. Like when we buy coffee in Ethiopia, for example, we have to pay through the central bank. And, you know, my producers are not getting their money released by the central bank. You know, like it's a very, very difficult thing. And if we can, now we have the mobile phone. Right, so now we have a device that can carry a transaction, and if we can enable the transaction down to literally the people who need that, it will work. I think we're a long way away from that.
We are. As with everything, even browsing the web and even emails and everything, like, so it'll take time, but I think one thing I've noticed in this world, the tech world, is that so many people are skilled now and are developed that, you know, things that would have normally taken 5 to 7 to 10 years 20 years ago, now just need like a year or two. Like, there's so many crypto projects out there. How did so many of them come up suddenly when nobody's really even using crypto yet? And yet you have so many of these companies out, which means that, you know, a lot of those tech geeks, guys, very smart people are able to get those differentiated projects out when there's not even enough demand for them yet.
So have you dealt with Provenance?
No, not yet.
Okay. So Provenance is the most important thing that's going to be added to the blockchain, right? Mm-hmm. So Provenance proves the blockchain and way, way more. But Provenance isn't the blockchain. So that's the next thing that's going to happen, right? So if I can give you an example.
Yeah.
If you go on a holiday and you go on a coffee holiday and you're going to go and see processing of coffee from a natural to a white coffee and go and see the gorillas in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. You know, wonderful week-long holiday suggests that when we get out of COVID, everyone does it. It's amazing. So what happens when you're down there and you take a photo? And you take a photo of a child that doesn't really look like they should be where they should be. And I, you know, like when you go to a coffee processing facility, seeing children, you should do that because sure. The whole, you know, the whole process is about a family orientated, it's a village and, you know, and that's important. But you see that child is obviously not very well or whatever. Now, you have some metadata on your phone, you upload that to the cloud. Provenance will then prove whether or not one of those companies is buying coffee from a place that's using child labor.
Oh, wow. Very right? Cool.
Now, so that's the type of thing that's going to make a difference. Now, sure, yeah. You add a cryptocurrency to it.
To right? Incentivize.
Which can help the whole system of making sure that you can provide for people. That's going to make a massive difference.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but we need some big banks behind it. We need some big banks who can get down to the level of being able to pay your power and pay your water and pay your phone. before that's going to work, right?
Well, that's yes. So, on the one hand, we need big banks traditionally, as we do today. But I think the beauty of crypto is that they have this new thing called decentralized finance, which allows those crypto projects to really replace those big banks through peer-to-peer lending without the need of a big bank.
Yeah, but I don't agree with you because I cannot get trade finance for my business, right? I'm a very secure, right? I've got a balance sheet that people would get quite excited about, right? So I've got all the right things going and I cannot get trade finance because the product I'm purchasing is only worth the value that I'm prepared to pay, right? Because there's not a stated value for the coffee that I'm buying because the people who have the power want to drive the price of coffee down to as low as possible because it's a commodity, right? So they might say that the coffee that I'm buying is worth $1 a kilo.
As opposed to
10, 15, right. 30, yeah. 50, $100 a kilo.
But these are the big finance, these are the big banks, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But this, so it's still very theoretical at this point. So let's see if it actually comes through. But the idea of this kind of decentralized finance world is that if the invoices or whatever is on your balance sheet that can really authenticate the demand and the value that you have for your coffee is truly worth $10 instead of a dollar,
right.
You should be able to collateralize that, tokenize it, and basically go as far as even mortgaging what would be an unofficial asset by a normal bank by these new financing fees. Again, it's all theoretical at this point. So no, today, who is using DeFi? Only the market participants who are in the crypto space, usually the miners and other crypto projects. So somebody like me or like you, not yet. Theoretically speaking, I can see how it could work. But let's see, if it does, this could really, I mean, I don't see how banks could be relevant anymore when you could just get a proper loan in fiat, in dollars or dirhams, whatever you want.
I'm gritting like a Cheshire cat. Give me 3 months and I'll show you how we're going to do it. Seriously. Provenance is the key.
Yeah.
Is actually being able to provide that provenance that guarantees that what you're seeing on the blockchain is real.
Yeah, yeah.
There are some stuff that's coming out, and this is going back to the coffee industry, right? So the coffee industry is basically now made up of people who are capitalists, right? Because the specialty coffee industry is about people going, oh, that's kind of good. It doesn't really hurt anybody. We're adding value to other people. So now you've got a whole bunch of very, very intelligent people joining their industry, and they're going, okay, so how do we make it end-to-end better?
Yeah.
Right? It's not just about making a coffee on your coffee machine. It's about making the whole chain better. The interesting thing is that the worst coffee can also be the best coffee. So if I can support a farmer who can actually grow that tree better, then I'm actually going to increase the value of that tree exponentially.
Right, because you're doing all the things that you can do after you get the beans from the roasting process and everything to get it to a point where I wouldn't even be able to tell if this is coming from score 10 or score 5 because of the process that happens after you source the beans. But even better when the beans themselves have been improved, right?
So if the tree is healthy, the tree is mature, you know, the soil is better and all that sort of stuff. So like we've been assisting with, by buying the coffee with farmers who, just basically going and looking at their soil. So one of the things that our lovely friends at Monsanto, bunch of pricks, Monsanto basically did is said they invented this product called Roundup. And Roundup is basically what it does is it stops the uptake of chloroform into a plant. So you spray it on something and weeds won't grow. So you genetically engineer a plant to be resistant to Roundup, and you can grow that. So one of the things that they did was soy. So they took soya beans, they made a generic version of soya beans, you spray Roundup on everything, it kills everything else in the soil, only the soya will grow. Now the problem with that is that the genetic ownership is owned by Monsanto. So Monsanto then can only sell you the seeds. And what they also do is make that the genetic engineering that those seeds will not regenerate.
Oh, wow.
So you have to buy the seeds every year. And this happened, I'm not sure how many years ago, I think 6 or 7 years ago in India, where they were given free seeds to grow soya. The next year they took the seeds and they replanted them, they didn't grow, and they said, no, you have to buy more. So, you know, we had all these Indian farmers committing suicide because, you know, one harvest.
Wow.
Terrible, terrible, terrible things. So Roundup, I remember when I was, 20 years ago in New Zealand, and I, would spray it on my driveway to stop the weeds growing through my concrete. you know, that was a wonderful product. Now I realized how bad that is. And Guyanese phosphate, which is what Roundup is, if you go to Cambodia, if you go to Vietnam, you know, you see it being sprayed everywhere now on rice, and they've re-engineered this stuff. Now, Guyanese phosphate is not a good thing in your body, and we're just slowly ingesting it. So one of the things that through the guys I'm working with in Colombia and stuff, is they've worked out if they put massive amounts of lime back onto the soil that's had Guyanese phosphate on it, it actually returns the soil back to normal.
Interesting.
Right now, an average farmer who's earning $600 a year, you say to him, you've got to go and put $1,000 with a gallon of phosphate on your farm, and then we can plant some coffee trees, and then we can grow coffee. He's going to go, yeah, but what do I eat? So, you know, if we can start to work at a micro level and start to help these people and start to change it, you know, in 10 years' time and 20 years' time, we're going to be in a better place.
Sure.
Right? And we're going to be drinking better coffee than we've ever drunk before.
Right.
Because, you know, we've got the technology, we understand it, you know, we've got people who, you know how to, you know, for me to arrange to take seeds from one country to another, as long as I stick with biosecurity rules, is relatively simple, because I used to fly all over the world.
Right.
Right. You know, and I can take a couple of kilos of seeds from one country to another.
Yeah.
The farmer that's receiving those seeds has no idea what these are. They have no idea that you're drinking $100 geisha.
Yeah. 100%. You know? I actually don't think we pay enough for coffee, considering how much we like it. But that's, again, privileged Dubai resident me. But I hear what you're saying, and I'm optimistic about even better improvement, because you can still get good coffee under the shitty circumstances that we're in right now. Like not us, I mean, sorry, the farmers. So you can only imagine how the only way is from here is up, basically, right? I mean, in theory. Yeah,
well, you know, a lot of those farmers were abandoned by their governments, you know, during the COVID times, right? And you know, there was a lot of trouble to move coffee from one place to another. You know, you think about it, that if a truck can't drive from one place to another, you know, how are they going to actually move the coffee around?
Sure, yeah.
We were lucky. We had coffee moving. Like I said it before, you know, we think a lot of the stuff that we do is good luck rather than good management. But we had containers on the water when COVID hit. And so those containers eventually got to us. But a lot of people I know, they ran out, you know. Or they had to buy coffee that was second rate, or a lot of places couldn't harvest.
Yeah.
Right? They just couldn't get people, because there was restrictions that meant that people couldn't actually get in to do harvest. So it's been the coffee world is going to be a bit upset this season, because you remember that stuff you're drinking was harvested last year.
Right. Fair. So let me ask you about espresso particularly, because I am a big espresso drinker. I only discovered, okay, let me tell you the kind of the context of this upcoming question. I drink, what is it, 2 espressos a day, maybe 3 sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I did not know, and I also at one point proposed. So I learned a couple of years ago that diamonds have the 4 C's, clarity, color, carat, and I think what's the 4th C? Clarity,
you sacrificed 2 months of your salary, did you?
Yeah, so that's the rule, right?
Yeah.
No, I think I had to come up with a different formula at the time, but I did what I did. But there are 4 C's for diamonds. And then it turns out, and when I got this Rocket R60 machine, that brewing espresso has something called the 4 M's, which are, according to the catalog from Rocket R60, the macchinatura, the mescala. Actually, let me read this out. Espresso coffee brewing is defined by the 4 M's. The macchinatura is the correct grinding of a coffee blend. Mescala is the coffee blend. Macchina is the espresso machine. And mano is the skilled hand of the barista. So when we just get an espresso shot, there are different things going on. And each one of those 4 M's apparently play a different role in how good the espresso shot that you're getting is. Tell us about those 4 M's and like educate us on what's going on here in the espresso making part.
The Italians are the masters of making machinery, right? You have to, right? If you've seen anything that comes out of Italy, I mean, New Zealand just beat the Italians with the sailing today, which was fantastic. But you know, you know, it's even more lovely to best in Italian, because they do – whatever Italy makes is beautiful, machinery-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Their coffee's shit.
Like a Ferrari.
Yeah, Ferrari's beautiful, but their coffee is shit, right? So the Italians, even the Italians that I know, and I've met some people who are very high up in the Italian coffee industry, and they admit now that their coffee's shit, because what they did is that they took – what was a beautiful seed, and they over-roast it. They make it super, super dark, but they make the best equipment. One of the things that a lot of Italian companies have suddenly realized, especially the equipment manufacturers, is that water is more important than anything else. So you think about an espresso. It's 25 to 30 mils. In that, 99.3% of it is water. So if the water is not right to start off with, your espresso is going to taste terrible, right?
Right.
So in Dubai, we have a problem with water. We have very, very safe, beautiful systems. We have everything. But the water here is desalinated, and it contains a mineral that is not bad for our body. In fact, our body requires it. In fact, a lot of the stuff that happens in your brain requires chlorides. And we have a huge amount of chlorides in our water here. And 10 years ago, the chloride level here was very low. Now it's got higher. I don't know why. I take a guess that we're desalinating more water and then we're using the same water over and over again. The chloride level's gone up, but that's just a guess. The chloride loves eating stainless steel.
Okay.
Right. So your coffee machine is made out of copper and stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
And so it eats that. And chlorides also make espresso, especially because that's a concentration of coffee. It makes it taste bitter and sour. So the number one thing is use the right water. And I hate to say this, but the best water that you can use in Dubai is either Cokes or Pepsis. So Awa or Aquafina.
Oh, right.
Is it okay. Aquafina?
Like you're right. Aquafina is Pepsi and Awa. Yeah.
Do you know why? Because these guys know how to make a soft drink, right? So they know that water is super important.
Right.
So they've got their water right.
So the low chlorine version, because I think they have two different...
Chloride.
Chloride, sorry.
Yeah, chlorine is not something we have here. Chloride
sodium. Ions. Sorry, I was thinking sodium in my head. So so there's difference to the water in terms of the sodium and the chlorine, or just the chlorine? Or
so there is sodium, which is salt.
Right.
So what happens is that, little bit chemistry here, mm-hmm. when you desalinate water, you have NaCl, yep. sodium chloride, right? That's the salt in the water, which is H2O. What the way that they desalinate is to push it through a membrane, which is like a really fine sort of filter, but it's not actually a filter. They have a high pressure, low pressure side. And what's meant to happen is that anything that is bigger than a hydrogen atom or an oxygen atom is not able to go through.
Mm.
But what happens is that the chlorides themselves actually go through, and there's a whole technical reason why they bypass and they send salt water around the thing, because that's a little bit of salt's fine for us.
Is that osmosis, by the way?
It is reverse osmosis, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, but reverse osmosis is meant to remove all the chlorides, but it doesn't in our water that we have here. And that those chlorides are just the enemy for your machine, and it's also the enemy for the taste of your coffee.
Right,
right. Right. So if you can remove those, that's super, super important.
Interesting. So the water as a base, very important.
Yep.
Then the other four M's. Basically.
Right. Then grind is right. So when you're making coffee, what you're trying to do is get the solubles out of the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the way that you do it is you take a big bean and you make that 1,000 times smaller than what it was by grinding it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the amount of the solubles that come into the water are determined by three things. The time, so the amount of contact time that the water has with the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
The temperature, so the higher the temperature, the faster the solubles will move out. And the turbulence, so how much agitation. So in an espresso machine, you're talking about pressure. If you're talking about any other method where you're stirring or doing anything, that's also turbulence, right?
Mm.
So when you're looking at the solubles that you want in the cup, there's good ones and bad ones. So if you take coffee and you soak it for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and you stir it up at a really high temperature, it will taste terrible
mm-hmm.
because it's got the good things and the bad things, right? So, you know, you think about something lovely like this, mm-hmm. which has been distilled. We're wanting the good distillation, not the bad distillation. I don't know, you know, you like a single malt?
Yeah.
So when you're doing a distillation, you have the heads and the tails and the hearts. Have you heard about this in
no.
distillation?
Interesting.
Okay. So at the start of a distillation, you have basically poison that comes off. You cannot drink it. So those poisons, we want to throw those away. And then that's called the heads. And then you have the hearts, which is all the beautiful, sweet, beautiful that thing. And then you have the tails, which is the nasty stuff. In coffee, it's exactly the same. We have, well, not quite exactly the same. We don't have any poison at the front, but we have the nice stuff in the middle, and then we have the bad stuff at the end. And that bad stuff generally tastes bitter. So when you're making an espresso, for example, you want to make sure that you actually cut the process off in enough time that you're getting the best flavor.
Mm. So 30 seconds, 25 to 30 seconds.
Yeah, but so now we've got this whole complex thing. So yeah. we've got the time that we're exposing, that you want to do 25 seconds. We've got the temperature, which is set on your espresso machine. But if you've got a bad espresso machine, it's going to vary.
Right.
Right, which is why your espresso machine is fantastic, because it's stabilized. But then you've also got the turbulence, whether or not the pressure is going to adjust. But then the grind, so the long story coming all the way back, if you've got a very, very good grinder, it is going to give you exactly the same grind size all the way through.
Right.
Right. And we're talking about microns.
Sure.
Right. So if you have a low quality grinder, what happens is that you have boulders and rocks and very, very fine particles as well. And it's going to extract at different times. And so some is going to come out really fast and some is going to come out slow.
Oh, wow. That's like the opposite of a single malt, right? So when you start getting multiple distilleries mixed
exactly.
in.
Yeah. So this is the thing, is that the grinder, after the water, the grinder is super, super important.
Right. Yeah?
If you're going to, I say to people, forget the espresso machine. Buy the most expensive grinder that you can afford.
I agree. Yeah. Right?
And then once you've got that, then the machine, for all those reasons that I just said, you know, giving stability and all that sort of stuff, that's going to make a huge difference.
I actually was not even aware. I'm going to go ahead and do some grinding was until I got introduced to Raw. This is your website, and you can basically see, by the way, hands, you know, honestly, touche. And kudos for an amazing online ordering experience. I'm a tech geek myself. I love, like, my first company was a tech startup. So I know what goes through the user journey of developing these kind of, like, online platforms and so on. It might not be too advanced, but I know enough to know that this was not just, like, done quickly.
And my marketing team is working on this furiously at the moment because they are not happy with it yet. So this is the people that I get to deal with now, is that most wonderful thing in my job is that we're now in a situation where we are able to employ people that are way better than us at doing a job. And,
So this is, like, look at that, for example. I mean, for anybody who's watching, anybody who's listening, we're looking at the Raw Coffee Company website. And look at all these different options that you have for the grind. Let me just try to zoom in a bit.
The best thing you can do is buy your own grinder, to be honest.
Right.
But what we do is, I think that we have about 16 or 17 different grind sizes that we measure. About once every 2 months, we go through... It's a process, it's an ongoing process of trying to work out every coffee that we sell and then optimizing the grind size for that particular brewing process.
Or the machine as well. Like, I remember when I went to your store, they had the grinds based on what machine do I have, right? So that's
which is something that we're constantly doing. And of course, coffee is also hydroscopic, so it's taking on water and letting off water as well. So we, you know... Always best grind just before you make.
Yeah.
But we try and get it as right as possible by testing and testing and testing to make sure that this time of the year, that particular coffee with that brewing process is going to work. You can imagine how much work goes into it.
I got my personal trainer. I have a personal trainer for my shoulder surgery, and now he's got his Rocket R, not the R60. He's got a Rocket machine. I think it's Apartamento.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he's got the grinder, the Sette. He's got the one that does the weight. Mine doesn't do the weight. I do the weighting separately. And it's just a fascinating experience when you go into this process rather than just, like, getting it off the shelf.
Have you got to the level where you're playing with it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I have to waste two or three shots every time I get a new bean because I need to understand the. Mm-hmm. But it's generally at a 2E, 2F, and then more or less, I never go down to one or over three. So somewhere it's always in the vicinity of a two.
How are you finding when you want to manipulate the flavor? What mm-hmm. Where have you got to when you want to manipulate flavor?
Great question. So I have the Rocket R60, which allows me to adjust the pressure throughout the extraction. So one thing I could do is like put a pressure at like usually like at like around a 7 or 8 for the first 10 seconds, push it all the way up to like a 10 or 11 and then back to 9. That gives you kind of a mix throughout the sipping experience. That's one way to do it. The other has just been the beans, just like changing the beans, keeping it at a 9 bar pressure, do nothing else. Same standard 25 to 30 second extraction to get double the amount of weight of beans, but just changing the beans, right? Like that's all I've done. I haven't played with anything else. Of course, I got to adjust the grinding so that I get the extraction done at the same time. But it's amazing how many different flavors of coffee you can get just by changing the bean, right? Like, and I still think the Sumatra you guys had, which I hope you bring it back. I think it was ran out of supply. There's no more availability at Raw for the Sumatra one. But the next best one that I like is the Huatango, the Guatemala one, which... When I every time I go
you're
there,
you're getting excited. Oh, we've got something coming for you.
Yeah.
Oh, the new Huawei Tango is just spectacular. I've never had coffee from Guatemala this good.
But here's the thing: I like the washed ones more for espresso. Whereas when I go to the store and I love having a chat with the guys there because they seem to know like just they describe to you what's going on with each bean and so on. Natural seems to be the main recommendation, but I seem to like the washed more when it comes to espressos. Yeah, what's going on here?
It's because the bosses like naturals.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. I love natural coffee.
Okay.
And, you know...
How does it affect the washed natural in the process?
Yeah. Look, so there's just more flavor in a natural, I think. To be honest, the first time I ever tried a natural in 2010 in Ethiopia in a cupping lab, I hated it. I thought it was fermented. I thought it was just disgusting. I thought it was off. Mm. And then I started to understand what a natural means. Mm. To be fair, naturals, a lot of my friends who are, you know, international judges for coffee competitions and everything don't like naturals. They like washed. And washed coffees give you a finer, more exquisite flavor profile. Naturals, basically what the difference is that a natural coffee... The fruit is picked, it's cleaned, and then the fruit is left to dry attached to the bean. So you get more fruit sugars, you get more flavors in there. And now in the last 3-4 years, we've been manipulating a lot of those flavors by using fermentations. Mm-hmm. So using anaerobic fermentations, so without oxygen and with oxygen fermentations, and some extreme stuff. Like we've got some coffees now that we have been fermented for 120 hours, which is just insane. Mm. You didn't do this 10 years ago. And these coffees have just such strong flavor profiles that I love them, but I wouldn't drink them every day. Mm. Like, so my go-to favorite coffee for the last 3 years for breakfast in the morning is a Mexican, just a plain Mexican coffee.
I like that one too.
It's just beautifully chocolatey sweet, and you know, it's just a lovely coffee.
Yeah.
But I've got coffees that I can pick up 15, 20 different flavor notes in them.
So here's a fun question here. Does preference in coffee have any indications about a person's personality? Or I think at one time I came across this article that said, you know, if you like this kind of coffee, this is what your preference in sex. Like people who like black coffee are a certain type when it comes to sex. Or, and then of course, a lot of this might be conjecture, but maybe from your own personal experience, but also from what you've seen, or maybe there's some science to back it up, empirical or otherwise. Is there any relationship between your preference to coffee and personality traits? Sex specifically, and other things that you think there's a correlation there, or
I think that there could be, but I also think that there's a huge amount of people who haven't had a really good coffee
or good sex. fair enough.
I say to anybody, give me 2 months and you will be drinking single shot espressos.
Right.
You can be drinking a, you know, half shot soy based latte with three sugars in it. Mm-hmm. You haven't had the right sugar yet.
Right.
Oh, sorry. You haven't had the right coffee yet. So I think that there absolutely could be exactly the same reason is they haven't had the right sex.
Yeah, as well, right? So, but the one that, so it seems that, in fact, here, let me do this again. Pull this up. That was one article I came across just before our stream that says, basically, this is on Food Beast. Let's zoom in a bit. Black coffee. Personality traits, old school, purist, positives, patient, efficient, keeps things simple, negatives, set in their ways and are resistant to making changes, abrupt, dismissive, quiet, and moody. I like my coffee black, and this is not entirely wrong about black coffee. Then you go down here, for example, for latte drinkers, and that's personality traits, comfort-seeking people, pleasers, open books, and like to soften the bitterness of life. Positives, generous with time and will go out of their way to help others, kind of like what pleasers do. Negatives, can get overextended easily and don't always take good care of themselves. And we can go through this list, but we're not going to do that. And I just think generally, not just with coffee, your preference to food can say a lot about who you are as a person, how adventurous you can be, how bold you are, introvert versus extrovert. A lot of this can be conjecture, I'm sure, but... it'll be interesting if you kind of give people coffee that is commensurate with their personality and looking and kind of tracking people and seeing how does that affect their productivity at work, their relationship with their partners. If you drink the coffee that is the right coffee for your type of personality, assuming there's any kind of relationship there, can you imagine for people starting off their day with the right cup of Joe that is just the right type of, you know how you say, like, for example, if you're in a certain blood type, you should not eat almonds, or if you have this kind of condition, you should eat fats of this type. So maybe something with coffee could be a catalyst to a better life here.
Well, yeah, I would hope so. There's a lot of other things in my life that I think that there's an exact correlation to what you're saying.
All right. Hit us with it.
So I cut carbs out years ago.
Uh-huh.
And carbs are not good for me. But I actually realized that intermittent fasting is better for me.
Oh, it's the best.
Right? So I've lost 25 kilos. Like, so COVID came and you could Netflix and pizza, or you could just get off your ass and do whatever you needed to do. And I'm lucky that I chose to get off my ass and do something about it. But you know, like intermittent fasting works for me.
Yeah, right? And especially if you mix it with like a no-carb carnivore diet type thing. I don't know how...
Well, yeah, I did that. I did the full keto for a bit.
Right.
I mean, one of my joyous memories is the fact that my grandmother told me that black coffee is the only way to drink coffee because, you know, wasting milk or whatever. And I don't like milk, right? You know, but so, you know, I've always, you know, said to people, you know, like, just harden up. You know, just drink black coffee.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm lucky because I, you know, drink the best coffee all the time, so I get the best taste profile. If you're drinking black coffee and it tastes like shit, you're drinking the wrong coffee.
True.
Right.
True.
It's that simple. But I gave you some cold brew. Yeah. You know, you drink espresso.
Yeah, this is delicious, by the way. I mean,
and that's just caramel and malt.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just coffee and water.
I think a shot of this is equal to like five espressos.
I think it lasts as long as three espressos. I don't think the caffeine content's the same as an espresso.
Right. It's just how you're digesting it then, or how you're metabolizing
it. I've got a theory about this. I was about to spend some money with some brilliant people who were going to do some investigation for us prior to COVID, and hopefully in the next year or so we'll be able to do it again. I think that the half-life on cold brew is double what it is with an espresso. And I think it's because it's brewed at a zero temperature or a 25 degree temperature.
Right. So basically, if I'm going to drink an espresso at, say, 1 p.m. and still be able to sleep by 11,
this will kick your ass.
Right.
You will not be able to do it. It just keeps lasting. But it doesn't give you that spike.
Mm.
It just sort of just comes up and then
nice.
Just
like microdosed the caffeine.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Right, so, you know, does certain food and certain caffeine and certain different things affect you? 100%. Mm. And your body type is, you know, you and I have a similar body type, right? So, you know, if like my metabolism, you know, started 3 weeks ago, mm. right? You know, it takes forever for anything to go through me. But the benefit that I've got is that if I drink, you know, I drink 3 or 4 double espressos to start off the day, and then, you know, in the afternoon I'll drink a couple of, you know, longer coffees. Like yesterday I didn't have any coffee at all.
Mm.
And did it affect me? No. You know,
you drink coffee usually every day?
Usually every day.
Okay. You know? And but one day you didn't drink it and you were fine?
It doesn't affect me.
Okay.
But you know, like my wife, I don't even talk to her until she's had 2 coffees.
I understand right. her. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I say it when I arrive at work. I say, you know, don't talk to me until I've had a couple of espressos. It's not necessarily that I need the espresso. It's actually that I want to have the time to actually arrive at work.
Right.
Get myself checked in, do my stuff, do everything, and then I want to deal with the day.
It's a bit of placebo then, more or less.
Huh? Yeah, don't tell anybody. All right. So I went from, you know, running, you know, roasting every day. Now I'm a CEO of a company with 60 people in it. Right. It's a different way that you have to deal with life.
Right, right, right.
It's
definitely not a placebo. I mean, I've had decaf coffee and I can tell the difference. And but I've been drinking coffee a lot. And I, you know what, actually this is the perfect time to ask you what, like on the health aspects of coffee, because I personally have experienced nothing but positive health aspects from coffee. Even when some people might consider to be excessive consumption of coffee, which is 2 or 3 double espressos. I mean, that's high by every standard. For me, I get energy, I get alertness, I work out when I drink coffee, I slack on gym when I don't. I typically can get like a palpitating heart, or, you know, if I'm drinking a lot of whiskey or whatever it is. Coffee, not so much. I mean, after you get used to it. So I have only experienced positive outcomes. And I've thankfully also did like a blood test recently, knowing that I drink a lot of coffee, and it turns out everything looks good. So I know this is just one, you know, anecdotal evidence, but what are the misconceptions about coffee when it comes to the good and the bad, right? So are there benefits that are over-exaggerated or untrue? Similarly, are there any unbacked kind of issues with coffee that are actually not true, but there just might be like a conjecture or, you know, the problem with a lot of these kind of epidemiology studies is that they look at samples of people, they correlate them with like cancer and death and other things. And you start to create causation when it's just a correlation. So a lot of the people who might drink a lot of coffee and have issues might have a bad health or lifestyle otherwise. And so you associate it with coffee, which is a very common mistake. But from your experience, and I know that, you know, are there any objective or close to objective insights that we can draw out of how coffee can improve your health or affect it positively versus negatively?
Well, I mean, one of the first things that is interesting that a lot of people don't know about is that coffee is not a stimulant, right? So people think that they think it's the same as cocaine, right? So cocaine is a stimulant, right? So coffee is not a stimulant. What it is it's like the easiest way to describe it is that you have receptors in your brain that accept certain levels of other chemicals. So in the case of coffee, what you've got is a receptor which is wanting to receive a signal to tell you to go to sleep. And what caffeine does is it blocks that receptor. It's like a cover, a condom going over the top of the receptor.
Mm-hmm.
And the strength of that condom over the receptor is going to delay when you go to sleep.
Right.
Right? So unlike a stimulant like an amphetamine or, you know, cocaine or whatever, that actually stimulates, that actually adds more serotonin to your dopamine receptors, coffee doesn't do that.
Interesting. Right? So same feeling more or less, but different things going on.
Exactly. Right. So this is why I talk about the half-life of a cold brew, right? So I will not drink cold brew in excess after 4 o'clock because I know I'm going to be awake till 2 o'clock in the morning. But
right.
But an espresso, for example, doesn't do that to me, which is why I want to get the study done to find out whether or not it's actually the way that you brew it, which is changing the chemical structure, which makes the condom stronger.
Like a double condom.
A double condom, yeah. Right. Heaven forbid we ever have to go back to that level.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting. I mean, sorry, you were saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is that the antioxidant effect, right? So I'm not sure if you're, you know, hugely into antioxidants. I think it's sort of something that's disappeared over the last few years. But when you drink any product, if you buy, heaven forbid, kale from the supermarket, you know, kale is cow lettuce. Antioxidants exist in fruit and vegetables and meat and everything that is naturally processed. If you buy a processed coffee, it doesn't have any antioxidants at all.
A processed coffee?
Yeah. Right. So Nespresso. Mm-hmm. Any instant coffee doesn't do it.
Yeah.
So if you are, if you're thinking that you're going to get your you know, some good benefit from drinking something that comes pre-ground, add hot water and it's instant processed, no, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
There's some people who are wonderful customers of ours who have been who have way better scientific knowledge about the benefits, health benefits from coffee. Keith Littlewood, who's based in Dubai. I think it's keithlittlewood.com. He's worth looking up. He understands a lot more than I do about it. And the conversations that I've had with him are about how positive that the caffeine molecule can do to your heart, you know, parts of your heart and other bits and pieces. To be honest, you know, I'm like you. I like to have a drink. I think that everything that we do has to be in moderation. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you eat too much red meat, if you eat, you know, everything probably apart from eating too many vegetables, I think that we could be affected by it. But
so too much vegetables can be bad.
Well, I don't know.
I've never taken a bigger dump in the morning. But other than
I think too much rice affects me.
Fair. Yeah.
Or quinoa. I'm pretty much over quinoa and kale.
I mean, if you're going to be doing a keto diet, I think quinoa is the best choice you have for like a base to food that also has protein and low carbs, relatively speaking, to rice. So what do you do like when you're in a keto diet?
Keto, I'm easy. I just eat meat. When I'm like, so there's, and but there's good, some good meats. Carne Store here now has some amazing meat here.
Yeah.
You know, grass fed. I'm not a corn fed boy.
Right. Same.
The only corn I have is in my
bed. Barley, right? Yeah, I actually. So you've met my dog earlier, and maybe next time you bring your dog and we have a play date. But I, you know, I've gotten into this carnivore diet for a while. I stopped it now, and I need to get back into it because it was the best thing that I've done to myself.
Right. But are you just shocking your system? Did you do it for an extended period?
So I did it for a month. 1 month only, but like, I actually wasn't entirely carnivore, so I still had like whiskey at night or coffee in the morning.
That's going to throw you off though, so that's not going to put you into keto.
Yeah, you're right, but here's what I did. So naturally, I stopped eating, I would start eating at 2 p.m. Steak, Wagyu steak, which I get from this amazing butcher.
But Wagyu's not good for you. The fat in Wagyu is just awful.
Yeah.
Right, you need to have an omega-3 fat, so you need to eat a grass-fed.
Yeah, beef. So I get that. So I got the Australian grass-fed beef, right? So
it's Australian, though.
It's not from New Zealand. I actually don't think these guys have it. So I get it from the place called Meat Avenue, which is a great butcher compared to the others in Dubai. But I also mix up salmon and chicken, and so it's not just meat. But then what happens is that I start eating I get pretty hungry by like 1 or 2 p.m., especially if I got a workout in, have some steak, dog eats with me some steak, so I think he's like the most privileged dog in Dubai or even in the world. By 6-7 p.m. I'm hungry again, grab a glass of whiskey, eat another meaty chicken, salmon, fish or steak. So I'm only eating 6 hours. So intermittent fasting is happening by default only because I'm not even hungry before 2 p.m. or even after my last meal at 8 p.m. Lost weight, high energy. I did that blood test I told you about. So testosterone was also high. Then I started looking into the health aspects. So on the onset, it sounded like it's a crazy thing to just eat meat. And then I looked it up. It turns out there are a lot of misconceptions health-wise about things like the LDL and HDL cholesterol, and how you know, there's the VLDL, which is basically the triglycerides. If these guys are, if your triglyceride is high, then you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. But if your triglyceride is low and your LDL and HDL are both high, in terms of cholesterol, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're in danger.
Yeah, but this is the thing that's a misconception with a huge amount of people about, you know, what we do is, you know, like, so, like, I totally agree with you. The problem with, if you have any alcohol, is that the ethanol needs to be burned off before your body's going to burn anything else.
So it affects, right? The metabolism.
So it's metabolism, right? So if you have a slow metabolism, if you add alcohol in there,
yeah,
that's going to cause you a problem, right? True. So, you know, what you're doing is exactly right, right? So, you know, you go out and you exercise. So you just know that you have to exercise longer.
Yeah, that's right? That's all it requires.
That's it, right? Yeah. I do, look, so... New Zealanders and Australians are, you know, we're brothers in arms, but, you know, New Zealand actually has more grass, better grass, and the meat that we grow in New Zealand is better, right? There's no question, right?
Agreed.
Yeah. The thing that I don't like is about any meat that's fed with a substitute that's not natural, right? So a corn substitute or another grain or something like that. So The reason is, and I've only just learnt this in the last few months, is that the fat that's produced in something like a Wagyu or a, you know, a number of these highly manufactured animals is not the good fat, right? So an omega-3 fat is...
like what you get in fish or salmon, basically.
Yes, but you also have to be careful because a lot of the stuff is farmed now, and then they're actually supplementary feeding salmon, and those supplements are not producing the right omegas,
right?
So if you're getting omega-3 rather than omega-6, then it's going to be a good thing. I'm going to hook you up with some beef that is the world's best beef.
It's grown
the cows just about surf because they watch the surfers surfing and the salt blows across, so they're nice and salty and
nice,
you know, I think that, like, if you just go into straight just eating massive amounts of meat, it's not a good thing,
right?
You have to listen to your body,
sure,
right? Your body is, like, so I know that, you know, like, I love to drink really good coffee. Like, I hope my wife's not watching because this morning I'm like a plumber that sink's leaking. I keep forgetting to bring coffee home, and I've been off for this last week, and I got up this morning and there was two shots of coffee in the grinder, and I knew that she was going to get up after me, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to have another one. And she managed to do it, and then she was like, well, we've run out of coffee. Oh, yeah, we did. But, you know, if you're, you know, you'd like to eat and drink things that give you pleasure, and that's fine. But if you listen to your body, you know when you've had too much.
Yeah,
right? You know when you have too much of everything. I mean,
this is the whole thing about listening to your body, right? It's like placebo. A lot of times you could eat something and in your head you're thinking, oh, I went vegan or I went carnivore, the total opposite, and I feel better and so on. A lot of times it's like this kind of expectation you have from what you should feel because of what you've been told you should feel about eating this or going on a certain diet. Like, there's this thing called also nocebo, which I came to discover, which is... if I tell you you're going to have medicine or food and it's going to have these side effects, and then I give you something that's fake, you will actually develop the side effects. It's like the opposite of placebo. So like with placebo, you might think you get better because I tell you this medicine is going to help you treat your disease. Nocebo is a real thing where if I tell you this thing is going to make you sick, you will go sick.
How many times have I felt like I've had COVID in the last year?
Yeah, for example. Right. Only just because it's there, right?
You know, like the brain is the most powerful thing that we have.
It is
fascinating. And, you know, one of the things that I've experienced in the last, so I turned 50 last year. I'm not acknowledging it. I'm going to have my 50th birthday when we can actually have a birthday.
Okay. Happy birthday.
But one of the things that I experienced over the last 3 or 4 years is that I started to get a bit older and I was overweight. I was definitely drinking too much. You know, I was definitely doing all those things because I had a business that I had to run and, you know, I had all these excuses. But one of the things that I discovered is that CBDs were something that made a huge difference to my life. And, you know, like I had a bad back. And, you know, I managed to get CBDs and started taking those. And the difference was taking pharmaceuticals to control pain to actually having mobility and having, you know, my life back and being able to do things and being actually able to exercise because I wasn't in pain and I was able to do. Like, I wasn't at the point where I'm taking, you know, like
opioids
stopping.
Or,
and, no, yeah. I wasn't like that. I was just like, you know, oh, well, you know, I'm just... It's easier just to have a drink to make, you know,
yeah.
it not feel bad anymore. So, you know, we as society are going to come through this whole lockdown and we're going to come through something else in the next few years that are going to mean that people are going to start to realize that they have to listen to their bodies.
Yeah, yeah, right. I hear you. I think you already start to see... a lot of this replacement of classic medicine for physical pain like back pain or even mental issues in countries like the US where you can get like the equivalent of what acid or LSD is or mushrooms. You know, you can get treated by your psychiatrist who will actually give you like microdosed acid or LSD or psilocybin or even ayahuasca. Not exactly yet a clinical solution in the US, but a lot of people seem to... You know, when we talk about listening to your body, plant medicine, especially that organic kind of untouched, you know, it's not played with, seems to have like a very profound impact, probably more on people who have issues, mental issues or child abuse or whatever it is, but also physical. Like I actually know the guy, you met my partner earlier, Georgia. We were in New York. And we went to this co-working space called The Assemblage, lovely place. The founder of The Assemblage in New York had cancer, terminal cancer, stage cancer, and he was like told that he needs to get his affairs in order, has a couple of months to live. That goes into Peru, that was like 5 years ago, and does ayahuasca, and the doctors couldn't believe it. It's actually part of the founding story of this Assemblage co-working space in New York, is that this man ended up not only treating this terminal stage cancer through ayahuasca, but then goes on to start this business, which today is one of the best co-working spaces in New York. So this connection between what you could consume and your body and what you might be going through physically or mentally, back pain, maybe depression or anxiety or whatever it is, as an alternative to everything else, all these fucking pills that you can get, opioids is one of them, but then the you know, everything, it's just the pharma industry, I think, is going to change completely. Yeah, so the food industry is going to change.
The pharma society that we live in is just so bad. You know, like you know what makes you feel better, right? So having a drink, there's nothing wrong with that. Right, that makes you feel better for a minute period of time, but tomorrow it doesn't make you feel any better.
Right,
right. So there are so many things out there that make you feel better.
Right,
right. And you know the stories that you're talking about. I have hundreds of friends who will tell you that they have suddenly realized that, you know, wheat makes them feel bad.
Right.
Well, okay. You know, there's a lot of things that are trendy and there's a lot of things that are cool for now, a lot of things that make, you know, that, you know, I'm intolerant to this or intolerant to that. Okay, that's good. But listen to your body. Like, listen to what's actually going on and maybe get some exposure to some other stuff that is actually better for you. There is... a lot of changes that are happening. My boys are living in Canada right now.
How old?
21 and 23.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they are legally are now allowed to try things that we're not allowed to try here. And it's very mm-hmm. interesting because my 21-year-old is sending me messages going, Dad, you know, really, you need to try some Girl Scout cookies because they're fantastic. And I'm just going, yeah, okay, maybe.
It's a good indica.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it sort of, you know, there is a lot of things that have been in our society
right.
for thousands of years that prohibition has meant that we can't enjoy them over the last 50 years. And I actually mean enjoy, because I've also got my in-laws who are now literally going, I'm 60 years old. I've never done anything but apart from have a couple of beers. And now society says that I can smoke a joint. And is there anything wrong with that? And I'm going, well, you know what? Okay, so there's all these good things that you can do for your body. But are you allowed to relax?
Yeah.
Are we actually allowed as people just to go, whatever?
Yeah, I mean, and it's also so much better. We typically do this with a glass of whiskey or a glass of wine. Like, oh, I had a tough day at work. Let me just like kind of, truthfully, health-wise, mood-wise, on every level, this shit is really the worst thing that you could do to yourself, like to your body and also to your mood. You get aggressive, you get violent, you get moody, versus like you can just get bubbly and giggly you know, even with sex. Like, I mean, there's no, the only thing that's bad about smoking a joint or doing some, I mean, cocaine and heroin and you know, when we start to go into synthetics and so on, probably should have some limits. Like, I think maybe if you give people who are depressed like access to any drug they could use, maybe they could destroy themselves. But with some things, I think maybe they could be, with the right kind of guidance and hand-holding, probably beneficial. And you already see examples of that in the US, where people who were hooked on heroin and opioids have managed to get off that and not kill themselves because they started smoking legal marijuana in some states, right? That's one of the things that you...
Well, yeah, but, you know, I also think that the environment that you're in is going to dedicate, you know, or predicate what you actually end up wanting to do, right? So if you're in a position where you are a coffee farmer in Peru, where your likelihood of starving for 3 months is, you know, pretty high, and somebody turns up with something that's going to make the pain go away, you're going to do it, right?
Yeah.
And that could be an opioid, and they might be trying to take advantage of you.
Yeah.
And that's happening in every country around the world.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the problem, right? So you and I have the luxury that, you know, that we can choose to drink a fine bourbon,
yeah,
you know, and we have that luxury. So I think that there's a lot of case, and adding a whole bunch of, you know, availability of something is not necessarily the right thing.
Not at all. I mean, I'll tell you one thing, that so I had three shoulder surgeries. I've also had some issues with my back 6 years ago, and I actually did take opioids as a medicine to kind of like numb the pain for the shoulder surgeries and all that. And I can safely tell you, somebody who's also dabbled around with everything from weed to acid and mushrooms and everything in between, that I can see how addictive it can get. Like taking those pills, which are basically heroin in a pill. Fortunately, we live in a city which controls the stuff to a point that I have not seen, for example, in San Francisco, which is where I also lived, where doctors will prescribe you oxytocin or OxyContin, whatever, like or Vicodin or whatever it is that the brand is, on demand. You might as well just go in and ask them for it, like chewing gum. And yeah, it's actually as expensive as a chewing gum, right? So you go into San Francisco and you go through this dichotomy, because you're walking down the streets in San Francisco where you see Uber and all these tech companies and all this innovation and all this like kind of wealth and the very expensive rent. And, you know, that's San Francisco, Silicon Valley. In the same exact block, we're talking about like the highest number of homeless people I've ever seen hooked on drugs, hooked on exactly those kind of drugs we're talking about here, the pharmaceutical opioids. And this creates this weird irony, right? You're in San Francisco, and yet you see all these like people hooked on these drugs.
But have you ever seen anywhere where opioids have been beneficial?
No, not at all. And I'm just glad that this in the city, they have a very tight control on it. Like, you need to really, like, they will only prescribe it to you after surgery, and that's it. You have to, like, you know.
But, like, so I have had opioids when, you know, in certain situations, and every time it's been a negative experience for me. It's not something that I enjoy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just wonder, like, so I learned something the other day that one of the things when you travel to Coffee Origins, and when you do it, when you're traveling around developing countries, is that you have a bad stomach, pretty bad.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I've taken Imodium for years as a placebo when I'm traveling.
Imodium is what exactly?
Imodium just stops you shitting.
Okay.
Right? Okay. And I found out 3 days ago that Imodium is actually a derivative of opium, that they modify the molecule to take out all the other fun receptors and it just makes you block up.
Oh, wow.
Right? So I'm going, okay, so these people who are addicted to heroin or morphine or whatever, they're constantly blocked up. I mean, what a miserable experience.
Right.
And for me, you know, I'm lucky. It's not something that I would enjoy. But there is so many other things that you could do. Look, you know, THC is a way better mood enhancer than alcohol.
Sure.
Right? You know, there's other things in the psychedelic world that should be way, way, way better for you to adjust what you're doing. But it's not recreational. This is
painful stuff.
Pain, maybe. Opioids are the way to go. But
no, I mean, like, these are not necessarily pleasant experiences, but are good for you. Like,
so we're so used to being in a society where we want to take something and it immediately fixes.
Right.
But that's not what life is about, right?
Right.
Life is about going through experiences that you have to adjust, and there's no immediate correction.
Yeah.
Right. But pharmaceutical companies are designed to give us an immediate fix.
Right.
Does it fix the problem? No.
It just numbs it.
No, it just stops the effect that we're getting right now.
Right.
Right?
100%.
Right? So we could sit here and drink two bottles of bourbon and regardless of what we're talking about, we wouldn't remember it.
Right. Whereas, for example, like the more purgy types or the plant medicine where you have to go through a really confrontational experience with your childhood or even like throw up or have diarrhea and it's not pleasant by any definition. Psychedelic as it might be, and definitely they are psychedelic and they're very intense in that sense, but they may not seem pleasant on the onset. It's not like taking a pill of an opioid or a line of or heroin or coke or whatever it might be, or your poison, but they can be regenerative, right? So they transform you as a person. In fact, I'm excited to get a guest in a couple of weeks who's you don't often typically get Arabic speakers or people who grew up in the Middle East who have also dabbled around with things like ayahuasca or DMT, or there's like a world of spectrum of things between those two or around them. But it turns out like these things can be transformational, and they're not comfortable for you to go through. Like, nobody wants to sit there and vomit in a bucket or take a shit in front of everybody and shit their pants. But
that's not the point of a lot of these experiences, right?
They're so, not. It's just a side. It's a byproduct of it.
So it's very interesting in the Middle East that you look at the plants that grow in this desert that we live in. They are psychoactive,
right?
Right. So it's maybe that, you know, in the last 200 years. I mean, how old is the UAE? We're turning 50 next
30,
year.
40, yeah, 50, I guess. Yeah.
50 next year.
Yeah.
Right. So 50 years the UAE. Wonderful country, developed more than we can possibly imagine. But the peninsula has been growing plants for however many thousands of years that actually are, you know, contain substances that, you know, will alter your state. So, you know, if we're looking for the last 50 years, we're doing really well.
Right.
If we're looking for the last 1,000 years, oh, we've got a lot of catching up. I mean, right. You know, you and I are a dot on the time scale.
True.
Right?
True,
and true. So maybe that the time scale that we're living in, we haven't had the teachers or the ability, because of prohibition, to be able to understand what things around us can deliver.
Right. But fortunately, if it's anything like the alcohol prohibition that happened in, was it 20s or 30s in the US, it's only a matter of time before, you know, people eventually act out and you know.
So, I mean, my personal experience of being able to have CBDs and what it does, just, you know, for me and hundreds of people that I know, just as a simple way of just making your body work. Yeah. I've got friends in New Zealand who have been working a lot more with it, and there's a system in your body called the endocannabinol system that requires, I mean, we have these systems in our body, and in 1930 the world prohibited us from taking a up dose of these
CBDs
by the endocannabinol system.
Yeah, I mean, I understand with when it comes to marijuana, you have the THC, which is the more like psychoactive ingredient, and then you have CBD that will not get you high, but will treat you in many ways, or even make you get you relaxed or so on. When I was in London a couple of years ago, there were stores selling CBD. Like, you would look at the bud, the marijuana bud, and you're like, all right, this is like, I'm going to smoke weed right now. And like, you smoke it and you don't get high, but you get relaxed. It's like smoke. It's like the equivalent of drinking chamomile, maybe, I would say. Or, but you sleep well. I know that I don't have any epilepsy, thank God, or any other kind of chronic issues. But I've seen videos of like parents even giving some of their pets, not even their children, who have like issues, a little bit of drop of CBD, and like, my God, what a miracle!
Well, the challenge that we have today is the what are you taking? Because sure. Prohibition is causing people not to be able to deliver, you know, what the good things are.
Right.
I am not an expert in this, and I have very limited experience, because one of the things about living in this region is that we're not allowed to experience any of these things. So, but what I do know is that you have a cannabinoid system in your body.
Right.
And that is natural. It's a little bit like I was talking about water before, and the water has some things that make coffee taste bad,
right.
But they're actually part of the brain uptake. And so what people are starting to discover today is that we need these cannabinoids.
Sure.
Now, they're not things that make you high. They are just basically things that occur in right. your body, and we have restricted the ability to uptake those. Now, one of the interesting things that people don't know is if you eat marijuana, it doesn't make you high, right? So you have to smoke it. You have to burn it. You actually right. have to change the temperature of it. So
with hash brownies and all that stuff? Like,
well, yeah, they've yeah. been heated. So
right, fair enough. You know, they've been cooked, and the chemistry has changed.
But if you just take the plant and you just eat it, doesn't make you high.
So the cannabinoids is what's going on. I see what you're saying. Right.
Yeah.
DMT is this other thing, which turns out when you're dreaming or when you're a child, was it? If I'm not mistaken, I think if your kids or babies have a lot of the DMT production in their brain, when you're dreaming, you're definitely producing DMT. And when you're dying, a lot of DMT is produced. So this is one drug that has been transformational for people who have tried it. They get to interact with all these allegedly extraterrestrial, very loving, very compassionate beings that you don't even experience when you're in real life, obviously, because we're humans and animals and all that. But then people who have smoked DMT go to this place where they experience an interaction with themselves or something else, but some entity that is full of love and compassion, but it's obviously outside of the reality. But then DMT, which is what you're smoking, is also what your brain is producing when you're dreaming, when you're a baby, and definitely when you're dying. So this is what fascinates me. Like, this is a natural chemical compound that your body's going to produce in some circumstance, whether you're sleeping or whether you're dying, for example. And then you get to actually have access to it from plants like ayahuasca, and also smoking it, and you finish that trip. And your perspective on life has changed. Your ego has changed. I find this to be mind blowing, you know. And I find like we're years behind where we should be when it comes to that, because we know we have access to it, but we just prevent people from getting access to it.
But also, those compounds are available in just about every plant that you interact with them on a daily basis.
Like DMT.
Yeah,
it's in every plant.
It's everything. It's in very minute places everywhere that we are.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I think that there are. So what I understand is that the cultures and the around the world who have had thousands of years of understanding this stuff, they know how to extract it, and it's used to concentrate it and then give it to people at the right time.
Right.
Right. So, you know, we're in a, you know, we can order anything in the UAE. I used to joke, you know, 10 years ago about being able to order McDonald's. Right. So you and I take that for granted. But in New Zealand, right, ordering McDonald's was like, really? Yeah. You know, you can't order McDonald's.
Yeah.
You know, but we're an instant demand society, right? So now we want our psychedelics on demand. You know, we want to have it now.
Yeah.
But that's not what thousands of years ago people dealt with, right? Yeah. They were delivered through, you know, plant-based medicine, and you know there were people who were experienced in this, and they made sure that from a young age that people were given the right compounds, and probably they were given just as much as they were given psychedelics. They were given vitamin C, and they're given vitamin B and vitamin D.
They were
balanced, right? Because they understood what was required. Today we live in you know, tiny little bubbles where we have to control everything because we're not treating our bodies correctly. We're not doing everything. So we now have to change everything.
True.
I mean, I've been taking 10,000 milligrams of vitamin D for the last year because, you know, like, I love to get out in the sun. I love to.
It's not enough, apparently.
Well, it's not enough, apparently. So, you know, like, all these things that we're doing, you know, that we've created it. You know, so maybe all these experiences, like I know some very, very clever people from Silicon Valley. I know some very, very clever people who are going down and doing IR experiences down in Peru. And, you know, and they're enjoying those experiences because you should. You're allowed to enjoy an experience.
Right.
But
and improve your life. It's not just, I don't think it's as recreational as it is transformational. I mean, I'm sure you're going to enjoy it at some level, but I think it's like, if you want to have fun, there are drugs to have fun. If you want to figure something out in your life, I think there are drugs for that.
I think some people push it.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. You know, like I think that, you know, just because you can afford a plane ticket down to Peru and you can go and do an ayahuasca experience, that you should go and do it. I think that I honestly think that sometimes you need to just go, really?
Yeah.
Do you need to be the next best person because you've done an ayahuasca experience?
Right.
Maybe that's a good idea. Or maybe you could just meditate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could get, so there's holotropic breathing and all those kind of breathwork exercises that you could do, which I haven't managed to get there. I do have some interesting breathwork exercises, but some of them are meant to actually get you to activate DMT somehow. Maybe not as much as ayahuasca would, or even smoking it outright, but turns out, you know, you could, in theory, release DMT through breathwork and through very deep meditation and reap the benefits of that experience.
But do we have to go as deep as DMT?
Maybe not, I guess.
I'm a diver.
Right.
I've been diving since I was 8 years old. And for the last year, I haven't gone away for a month's worth of diving. And the diving that I've been doing, I told you before that I have a place in the Gili Islands.
Right.
And that was my DMT holiday.
Under the water.
Under the water, you know, doing 50, 60 hours in a month, just being in nothing.
Yeah.
You know? I suffer from tinnitus.
What's that?
It's ringing in your ears.
Okay.
It just constantly rings in my ears. And for some reason, when I dive, it disappears.
Mm.
And, you know, like just going down and I have young boys, and as a older father, I want to compete with them. So, you know, my young boys are, you know, go deeper, go longer and everything. And so now I'm a technical diver, so I go quite deep at, you know, and using different gases to go down to different levels. And I've discovered that reducing the amount of oxygen that I have reduces my tinnitus and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And I have no idea if there's any scientific aspect to it. But also the fact that you focus your brain on one thing that is not about what is happening in today's life.
Right.
You know, for me to have that decompression, which is ironic when it comes to diving, but have that decompression for a month of actually having a place where I just go and do nothing but focus on that, because I'm doing something that is physically very difficult, and also if I do it wrong, I die.
Right.
So I'm not doing recreational diving. I'm doing very deep diving.
Survival diving.
Well, no, it's just that we go down to levels where we can't come up.
Yeah, you're not just hanging out there, basically. Yeah.
No, and I love the whole aspect of looking at fish and doing all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But the actual mental aspect of actually totally focusing on doing that is a release, right? Doesn't require me to go to Peru to the jungle and do ayahuasca and throw up and shit.
Fair enough.
But equally, what we have to do is everything that you can do in your life, I think that you can actually find aspects of it.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's that would be the ideal evolutionary state, if you can activate that heightened state of mind and awareness and the consciousness without any kind of help. And I think, as you said, different people have different ways of getting there. Last time I had a guest on, we were talking about the flow state, which is like if you do anything in a high challenge and you're good at it, you're there, right?
Yes.
Think about like a musician who's just making music and he's immersed, or he or she rather, or anybody else, like, or even somebody who's like coding, or like we're doing an Excel model, but like they're just like they know exactly what they're doing. They know all the shortcuts.
I love that situation. I get into that situation a lot, and I. When you can hit that flow state,
it's amazing.
God,
you lose track of time.
But you also, I've had it when I've been in selling. Like, right. I've actually been in a situation where I've been at a trade show, you know, when I was younger, where you were just, nothing could touch you for 2 days, 3 days. You just everybody that you interacted with just wanted to be part of your world, and you could sell.
Yeah.
You know, those things are fantastic.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. Matt, I don't know, how long has it been? We're almost close to 2 hours. I don't want to take up more of your time, but I have to say this has been absolutely fantastic. I'd love to have you again on the show. I also would love for you to bring your dog, and also for us to meet your wife. Hopefully we get to do this again. Thank you so much for coming. Do you have anything else you'd like to share with our listeners, our viewers, that we haven't covered, or we can?
Just been an absolute pleasure.
It's been, likewise, and I thank you so much for coming. Thank you again for this delicious bourbon. I'm a single malt drinker, but I might be switching to this because this is delicious. Buffalo Trace. Thank you so much for this. And I actually need to go to Royal Coffee tomorrow to stock up again, so I'll probably see you there. And that's it. That's a wrap. Thank you very much.